Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. It's Thursday. That means open forum, and we've got 2 hours with Jimmy Akin today. So your calls are welcome, 888-318-7884. As most probably know, when Jimmy's here, pretty much any question is welcome. Just dial that phone, 888-318-7884. It could be about religion. It could be about specifically about the Catholic faith. It could be about philosophy, morality, or maybe you got a science question or a alien question. It's all welcome. 888-318-7884. And you most certainly do not have to be Catholic to call. Anyone's welcome. Jimmy Akin, a senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, the author of The Fathers Know Best, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and many other things, as well as the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Cy Killett. I'm Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers. You are the host of Catholic Answers Live, if I understand correctly.
You do, in fact, understand correctly.
Awesome. I love correct understanding.
Has there been a glitch in the matrix? I thought you seem to be establishing facts that had already been in evidence.
Well, it never hurts to be sure.
Okay. Well, I hope you are sure. You have to believe me in order to be sure.
That's true. You could be lying.
I'm not, though. I'm Cy Killett, host of Catholic Answers Live. 888-318-7884 is our number. As I said, any call at all is welcome. Jimmy, tomorrow, Friday, another Mysterious World.
Yes.
What can we expect?
Well, so last Friday we did one on the new government UFO report and talked about that. So it's something completely different, of course. This time we're going to be talking about a woman named Pauline Dakin. And she is, today she's a journalism professor, but she had a bizarre secret childhood. Her mom would move her and her brother periodically with no warning. They were to a whole new town.
Wow.
Like across, halfway across the continent. And she was not allowed, she and her brother were not allowed to tell people when they were going on vacation or where they were going on vacation. Her mom would suddenly take them out of school for a surprise picnic in the forest. They would suddenly change their dinner plans. One day she came home and mom was throwing away everything in the fridge. Another time, she and her brother had walked across the carpet, and all of a sudden her mom has them wash their feet, put on socks and plastic bags over their socks, and then go out to dinner for a couple of hours and see a movie. And whenever she and her brother would ask why these strange things were happening, her mom would say, "I'll tell you when you're older."
And did she?
And when Pauline was in her early 20s, her mom summoned her to a hotel room, made her take off all of her jewelry, and then she and the family pastor told her the reason for all of this.
What?
And it blew Pauline's mind. And that was only the beginning of Pauline's introduction into a secretive realm called the weird world.
Okay. The only possible answer is aliens.
No.
It's not aliens.
To do with aliens.
What? Oh, I got to hear this one. Oh, Jimmy, you set that up. Good. It sounds like it might be slightly traumatic, however. Is this something she had to recover from, this childhood, or was...
She and her brother are both actually healthy, well-adjusted adults.
Huh. That's a pretty good accomplishment.
Yeah.
Again, the number 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, it's out there on the internet. Just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World or Jimmy Akin. You're gonna come upon it, and you can find out about the weird world.
The weird
world. All right.
That's what the insiders called it.
No, the insiders. Oh.
The outsiders didn't know it existed.
Oh, no, I'm freaked out again. Let's go start with Jose in Tucson, Arizona, watching on YouTube. Jose, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, I've done most of your apologetics courses online, and I found them very helpful. However, it kind of intrigued me to ask you if you can give me a suggestion or recommendation on some theological courses, also philosophical courses that would kind of strengthen my wanting to, you know, do apologetics? Is there something that a layperson can do that won't cost a fortune to achieve?
Well, so I would say a few things. First of all, we have plans to add philosophy and theology courses to the School of Apologetics. So, you know, we're building our curriculum right now, and in the course of time, we will be offering those courses. At least that's the plan. In terms of where to go right now, there are some other platforms that have some material that might meet those needs. You might, for example, check out Formed, mm-hmm. which is another platform. Where I would go now, I haven't checked the prices because you mentioned not losing too much money on the deal, or spending too much money on the deal. But there are universities that offer theology and philosophy courses online. Examples would include Catholic Distance University, which is, of course, set up to do distance education. I know Franciscan University of Steubenville has some distance courses they offer, and there are a lot of others, too. Also, you know, getting a good theology book and reading it yourself. I mean, that's one of the cheapest ways mm-hmm. to do it. Now, it's not going to be read to you by the professor, unless maybe it's an audio book, but just getting your own course materials and studying rather than taking a class per se is something that people can do. That's my primary mode of learning, is just teaching myself out of books and stuff, or these days also watching YouTube.
Okay, Jose?
Thank you very much. And before I go, I just wanted to put pressure on Cy to come out with the audiobook of his newest book.
When's that going to happen, Cy?
That's so funny because, Jose, thank you for saying that. It's funny because just this very morning I was talking with Eric, who is the guy. Eric does audio work here, and he's the guy that puts it together. I have finished reading it, and I specifically asked him. I said, "Was there problems with my reading? Because I'm happy to redo it." And he said, "No, it's not a problem with the reading, but they just have another really big project they're working on, and then they'll get to it. So then I'll get it to you." Okay, Jose?
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. That's very kind of you to ask about my book. Our number again, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And up next, we go to St. Louis, Missouri, listening on the Apple podcast. I didn't know that we were there live. Charlie, are you there with us?
Yeah, hi. How are you guys?
Very well. Thank you. Thank you for your call. What's your question for Jimmy?
Yeah, so my wife and I we're both Catholic, and we've been sort of friendly debating each other. And she has been learning, she brought this up with me, and I find it very interesting, that when St. Augustine translated the Bible from Greek to Latin, that the word, I think it's ainos, mm-hmm. I think, Jimmy, maybe you can help me out, it like meant like age long, or I think I looked it up, practically eternal, which doesn't mean eternal, and I think it had to do with like hell not being eternal, and like, you know, God will come and save people in hell. So I'm confused, because if hell is eternal, why purgatory? Or, you know, now we're sort of like, they can't be synonymous. So we're just sort of confused on like what that word, when it was translated from Greek to Latin, meant. Does it actually mean eternal?
Is hell eternal, Jimmy?
So, so first of all, it wasn't St. Augustine who translated the Bible from Greek to Latin. In fact, St. Augustine didn't even speak Greek. He was a Latinist, and he may have spoken like Berber or something, but he thought and spoke and wrote primarily Latin. The one who's famous for translating the Bible for the original languages, and he's far from the only one, but the one who's famous for it is St. Jerome. He translated the Old Testament from the original Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, and then the New Testament from the Greek. And the word that gets used in Greek for forever is Ion, and it's simply the Greek equivalent of another Old Testament term that gets used in the Old Testament, which is Olam. And these terms have a range of meaning. They don't automatically by themselves mean forever, but I mean, they can, for example, be used to mean for an age. or an age. An olam can just be a long period of time. But there are ways of communicating the concept of forever using these terms. For example, in the Greek New Testament, you'll frequently find the aion word used in a way that if you translate it literally into English, it would be the age of the ages. Mm-hmm. And so what it's doing is envisioning all of the different ages put together as one giant age. And that is another way of saying forever. It's the age of all of the ages. And so you do have ways of communicating very clearly the concept of forever. And one of those is in connection with the punishment of the damned. If you look in Revelation chapter 14, you'll see a description of what happens to the beast and his followers, and it says that the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they shall have no rest day or night. So this indicates that this punishment is unending. Now, whether it now really from a theological perspective, we know that it's a self-imposed punishment. It's not like God is a cosmic torturer. Instead, this is a way of expressing that these people have fundamentally chosen to reject God, and they therefore don't want to be with God, and they therefore are cutting themselves off from the source of all joy and goodness, and that naturally frustrates them because, you know, if you cut yourself off from the source of all joy, then guess what? You don't have any joy. Nevertheless, this is understood by the church to be a permanent state based on what Scripture teaches. And so it is different than purgatory. Also, purgatory is different in other ways, too. If you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it has sections both on hell and on purgatory. And if you look in the section on hell, it will note that this is eternal. But in the section on purgatory, it makes an additional point, which is that whatever suffering is involved in purgatory is entirely different than the punishment of the damned. Its purpose is fundamentally different. It's to help liberate us from disordered attachments to things so that we're fully open to God and that we're fully purified. And it's kind of, if you want to think about it this way, the spiritual equivalent of physical therapy. You know, you go to physical therapy, sometimes it hurts, but it makes your body whole. It heals you. And that's what's going on in purgatory. So it's not just a difference in time or length that makes purgatory different than hell. There's also a difference in what's happening.
Charlie, thank you very much. Appreciate the question. We'll have to leave it there because we have to take our first break. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest for both hours today. We'll be right back with more questions for Jimmy right after this.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hey, this is Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. I'll be delving into the fascinating world of miracles and taking you on a hunt that explores the greatest mysteries and marvels of the Catholic Church. I'll be examining what constitutes a miracle, how miracles are investigated and approved, and the role they play in the lives of the faithful. We'll look at the miracles of the Gospels and early Christianity, considering the claims of the miraculous in our own modern age.
The Miracle Hunter, Saturday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And before we head back to the phones, it's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin here as our guest. The 50% off on every single one of the Catholic Answers 20 Answers books. Jimmy's a recent one from Jimmy, Anti-Catholic Myths. Is that the most recent one? I think probably.
I don't remember.
Anti-Catholic Myths. I thought it was a great topic. Mm-hmm.
I think that was the most recent. Yeah.
But a nice, succinct way of addressing some of those things that are very commonly said about Catholics that are, in fact, myths. But there's dozens and dozens of these 20 Answers books. They're not very expensive to start with, $2 or $3 each. But right now, they're 50% off at shop.catholic.com. Up next, right here in California, listening on Catholic.com, Joseph. Joseph, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question regarding Matthew chapter 16, verse 18.
Mm-hmm.
It's a well-known verse. If you look, I used to be a Protestant, mm-hmm. and I used to read the King James Version. The part I'm asking you about is, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Catholic Bible, NAB, it states it, and the gates of the netherworld shall not prevail against it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, at least the Baptists that I know, do not understand how Christians can be in hell, and they can't explain this.
Mm.
I heard you give an explanation a while back regarding the Apostles' Creed, the part that says, according to Jesus, that he descended into hell.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, you gave two really good explanations. The first one, you said that the word hell, when the creed was written, if I'm quoting you correctly, that the word hell there meant death, the grave, not being into the fiery part of hell where you're burning. And then you also said that Jesus could have gone into that part of hell to show everybody there that God's promise had come true.
Joseph,
and he was there to show.
I feel like you're giving us a really good review, but I got to get you to a question. Do you have a question for Jimmy?
Yes, I do. My question is, the gates of Hades or the gates of hell, is it just meaning the grave, like in the definition
okay,
of the creed?
So in Matthew 16:18, the word that is used that is translated hell here in various translations, and it's not along Protestant Catholic lines, you'll find this word translated different ways. The word is Hades. And one way of bringing that into English is to just transliterate it and say Hades. The problem is, in English, Hades is often used as a synonym for hell, the place of the damned. Now, originally, hell in English, and this is in older English, did not mean the place of the damned. It just meant the place of all the dead. So if you were dead, you were in hell. That didn't mean you were suffering, because you might not be one of the damned, but you were said to be in hell. This is like in Old English. Because of the way the term hell has shifted in English to now where it just means the place of the dead, it's prompted other Bible translators to take another look at how should we translate this word here, because in Greek, Hades only means the place of the dead, not the place of the damned. And netherworld is a possible translation. It's not the only one, but it's a possible translation. So what Jesus is saying here is that the gates of the netherworld, meaning the place of the dead, will never prevail against the church. And that's another way of saying the church will never die. So Jesus is not talking about Christians being in either the place of the damned or the place of the dead. He's talking about the church is never going to die.
Joseph, thank you. I hope that was helpful to you. We're going to keep going because there's lots of folks on the line. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum. And now we go to Knoxville, Tennessee. Sean, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. Thanks, guys, for taking my call. It's a real slick app. So welcome. So I started doing kendo. It's a Japanese swordplay martial art.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun, good exercise. But when you enter the dojo, you have to turn around, bow, profound bows. There's kneeling and prostrations. Mm-hmm. Knees, head forward to the ground,
mm-hmm.
and that stuff. Even a Western culture, maybe a Japanese Catholic wouldn't have a problem, but that's stuff that I reserve for Jesus,
mm-hmm.
in front of the tabernacle or an adoration. So I'm not sure, do I need to, back off of that or basically tell the sensei, the person, hey, I like the martial art, the skill, but, no offense, the bowing is not really to seem misplaced reverence.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a flesh offered to idols type of situation where in the back of my mind, I know there's no effect here.
Okay, Sean.
Yeah, so what to do in this situation is up to you. There is no intrinsically wrong body posture, and there is no intrinsic association with a body posture in any particular meaning, when it comes to reverence. So if you in good conscience are able to recognize that, this is not worship. I'm just doing this because it's part of the tradition, then it's fine to do it. On the other hand, if you really feel uncomfortable with that and you're not able to get over that, well, then it could make sense to say, this isn't my thing. I was raised in a different tradition, and while I respect Japanese culture and the traditions associated with kendo, there are things that I don't personally feel comfortable doing, at least these particular ones. And if the sensei understands that, great. If not, you might have to find yourself a new dojo.
Thanks, Sean. Hope that was helpful to you. Jennifer in South Dakota is next, listening on Real Presence Radio. Jennifer, are you there with us?
Yep. Hi.
Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah. So I had seen a video recently, and I'm sure you've heard people, they get upset that wealthy people like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, they have all this money and they don't do things like solve world hunger. And this video made a claim that instead of being upset at people like that, you should really be upset at the Vatican and like the Catholic Church as a whole. Because supposedly they have enough wealth to solve world hunger twice over.
Wow.
They're a charity, technically. So, So you should be upset at them. And I have, my own ideas on how I would respond to that, but I just wanted to hear what Jimmy's take on that was.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer.
Well, there would be different ways of approaching it. One way of approaching it would be to simply share the facts with them. Another way would be to turn the question around and put them on the defensive. You could say, okay, you're making these claims. What's your basis? How much money would it take to solve world hunger? Because it's not just buying food for everybody. I mean, that's a lot. But if you're talking about actually solving world hunger, that doesn't mean giving everyone in the world a hamburger on a given day. It means having permanent food supply being delivered to people on a permanent basis. And the problem is actually not that that we don't have enough food. We got plenty of food for everybody on Earth. The problem is we have pockets on Earth that are economically and politically underdeveloped that prevent the adequate distribution of food in those areas. That's the real reason for hunger. It's corruption and lack of economic development in impoverished areas. If everybody in the world adopted economic and political systems like in the developed world, and if those were consistently applied throughout given nations, there would be no hunger. But let's suppose that you're talking to this person and you're wanting to get them to explain their case. You could say, so how much money would it cost to actually feed world hunger? And how do you know that? I mean, show me the math. Also, how much money does the Catholic Church have? And how much does it have? Because the Catholic Church has a divine mission from Jesus. It's not going to disband. So the Catholic Church has a certain amount of resources that it needs to fulfill its divine mission. How much money does the Catholic Church have above that amount? And how do you know? Have you been doing the auditing? Show me the math. If you can't show me the math, either about world hunger or about how much excess resources the Catholic Church has, then you're just talking without knowledge. You're just making claims that you have no rational basis for. Maybe you heard it from somebody. Maybe it's a claim that tickled your fancy and so you decided to run with it. But you don't actually have any evidence for it if you haven't been doing the math. So that's one way of approaching it. Another is to simply point out, actually, no, the Catholic Church does not have the money to solve world hunger. The Catholic Church, in fact, runs pretty close to the bone. In many years recently, especially, the Vatican has actually run a deficit. And it is doing things to help support world hunger and medical charities and educational charities and all kinds of different charities around the world. But actually, the Vatican itself tends to run at a deficit, or at least it frequently has in recent years. What it does have is some fancy churches that have been built over the centuries. Could those be sold off? Well, hypothetically, but they were based on donations. And if donors give you money for a purpose, like I want to build a church that will be beautiful and glorify God, you can't misappropriate the funds and divert them to something else. Like saying, oh, well, the donors wanted us to build a big cathedral that would glorify God, but we're going, now that we've received the donors' money, we're going to sell it off and spend it on something else. That's called misappropriation of funds. So there, the practical reality is that the world hunger, to the extent it's there, and fortunately it's nowhere near as bad as it used to be, is a problem of lack of economic development and political corruption. And by the way, Jeff Bezos and other people like that have a way more positive profit position than the Catholic Church does.
Jennifer, thank you so much for the question. Boy, lots and lots of calls. So good thing we got Jimmy with us for 2 hours. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Enter promo code EARLY to save $30. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
What's the one mistake you'll never make again?
That's tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Very groovy, Brandon. Very groovy, baby. Thank you very much for the groovy music. I've noticed, however, with Brandon, when you're here, Brandon, we might hear that groovy music again. I'm not saying that.
That's a bad
guaranteeing.
Thing.
No, I'm just saying. I've noticed you're very generous with the groovy music, and I appreciate it. Our number is 888-318-7884. I'll be honest with you, though, at the moment, lines are full, and we're going to try to get to everybody. Jimmy Akin is our guest, but lucky for us, we got Jimmy for 2 hours. So hang on. If you're online, we'll do our very best to get to you. Let's go to Jamie in Ohio listening to EWTN. On channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Hi, Jamie, you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Jamie, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right, thank you. So I have a teenage son who presents a question statement to me that I know has inaccuracies, but I don't know how to articulate and respond to him.
Okay.
So his statement is, if you have to believe in Christ to go to heaven, and I was lucky enough to be born into a Catholic faith and Christian culture, but there are others in the world who were born into other cultures and faith that aren't as exposed to Christianity, and they, like myself, are just believing in their faith and their culture and living that out, but they don't get to go to heaven. That's how is that fair, that we just happen to be lucky enough to be born into Christianity?
Well, it wouldn't be fair, and that's why that's not what happens. The situation is different than that, and the fact that your son is a teenager may be something that you can use to help him understand this. When he was younger, you know, there were a lot of things that he didn't know. And so you as a parent, and any parent, it's true in any family, didn't hold him accountable for things that he was innocently unaware of, you know. But as he grew, he gained in knowledge. And so now that he's older, he has more responsibility. He is responsible for the things that he does know. And if he, neglects his studies and fails to learn something that he should learn, well, he can be held accountable for that. You know, he could get bad grades, for example, or have to go to summer school or something like that. So you as a parent, and it's true in other families as well, because it's just part of good parenting, hold the child accountable for where the child is at. You don't ask more of the child than his age and situation allows for, but if you do hold him accountable for what he is capable of doing and what he does know and what he should know given his age. And the same thing is true of God, who is our Father in heaven. So in the case of people who have never heard about Jesus, God is not going to hold them accountable for not knowing about Jesus if it's through no fault of their own. He will hold them accountable for whatever level of light and grace they have received. But if they live up to that, then they can go to heaven too. They'll be saved through Jesus. They just won't know how that's happening in this life. They'll find out, oh, it was Jesus who saved me in the next life. On the other hand, if someone has been fortunate enough to grow up in a Christian culture, and especially if they've seen the evidence for Jesus Christ, well, then they're held responsible for how they respond to that upbringing and to that evidence. And so there's greater responsibility for those who have been privileged enough to actually learn about God and learn about Jesus and to see the evidence for God and his Son. As Jesus himself said, of whom much is given, much is expected. So the more you've been given, the more you're accountable for how you use the benefits that you've been given.
Jamie, you think that will help your son?
I think that was beautiful. Thank you.
All right. Great. Thanks very much. Appreciate that. Let's see. Where are we going? We're going to Michigan. Rob in Michigan, listening on Holy Family Radio. You are next. Hi, Rob.
Hey, thanks.
Happy to have you.
Question is, I'm a Protestant, and my understanding of the Catholic view on grace and faith works and grace working together is that you have to be saved by grace through faith, mm-hmm. but you also have to have works to shore up your faith. Does that make sense? I'm wondering your view on that.
No, it doesn't. It's not Catholic teaching. What is the absolute that you have to be saved is God's grace. And ordinarily that's given in response to faith plus a couple of other actions. The New Testament identifies three things that are part of its message of salvation in different passages. Basically, we need to repent of our sins, we need to believe in Jesus Christ, and we need to be baptized. And you do those three things, and God gives you his grace. Now, he has other ways of giving grace as well. It's like if someone can't be baptized for some reason, God can give them his grace. And as we just discussed in the previous phone call, if someone doesn't know about Jesus through no fault of their own, well, then God can still give them his grace, even though they lack faith in Christ, provided they are innocent and are otherwise, you know, living up to the grace that they have received. So the fundamental thing you need is God's grace. And ordinarily, that's given in response to repentance, faith, and baptism. Those are the three things you find in the different biblical passages that deal with how one enters a state of salvation. So let's suppose you do those three things and you enter a state of salvation and you're immediately hit by an asteroid without any chance of doing good works. You will still go to heaven. Good works are not required to get into heaven. you cannot do good works before you get into a state of grace, because it's the love of God that he puts in your heart with the state of grace that enables you to do good works to begin with. So you do not do them to get into a state of grace. They do naturally flow from being in a state of grace. St. Paul talks about how we're created in Christ for good works. So they're meant to be part of the Christian life. But even if you don't have them, if you got hit by an asteroid or phasered out of existence or something right after you were baptized, you would still go to heaven because you've got God's grace. So what's the role of works in the Christian life, of good works? Well, they obviously help us grow in our godliness. You know, we become, since a good work is an act of love, we grow in love by doing good works. We do them because of God's grace. But we therefore grow in his grace, we grow in love and holiness, what's sometimes called sanctification, and God promises to reward us for good works that we've done, so that we are also rewarded for them, but we don't have to do them to enter a state of grace. And while doing good works, living a life of love, does help build your faith and reinforce your faith, it's not like you will drop out of grace if simply for failing to do good works. The only thing that will take you out of a state of grace is a deliberate knowing grave sin, what's called a mortal sin, where you turn your back on God and say, I don't care about God. I care about this other thing more.
Okay. Rob?
Sounds great. Thank you.
Rob?
Oh. I was going to say, we have some resources we might want to send Rob.
I was thinking of sending him a Drama of Salvation.
That would be a good one.
Jimmy wrote a very fine book that explains this in much greater detail, and I think you'll enjoy it, Rob. It's called The Drama of Salvation. And if you'll hang on the line, Nathaniel will get your information, and we'll send you a copy of that book, all right?
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate the call. The number here is 888-318-7884. It's open forum. I think we're going to take a quick break. Before we send you off to the break, though, I do want to tell you what's on the Catholic Answers Focus podcast this week. We do two podcasts a week, generally. Every now and then, there's a bonus podcast. This week, we talk with the wonderful writer and speaker, Elizabeth Kelly, from the podcast Deep Down Things and other places, about is Christianity anti-woman? This is a common kind of trope that Christianity is anti-woman.
Spoiler warning, I think the answer is no.
Dang it, Jimmy, come on. We're trying to hold some suspense here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but she actually gives...
Well, then I won't tell you what Rosebud was.
Thank you very much. I don't want to start sledding down that hill. Is Christianity, not only does she answer as the yes or no question that is clear in the title, but she also elaborates on why the answer is no. And then we have another one that's a yes or no question, which is also elaborated upon. Layla Miller, we talk with her about, is divorce really a sin? We talk about the sin of divorce with Layla Miller. You can get them both at Catholic Answers Focus. Here's where. YouTube, everywhere they have podcasts, and CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
She is one of the most beloved saints of all time, honored as the saint of the little way.
Matthew Bunsen and the doctors of the church.
St. Thérèse of Lisieux entered the Carmelite convent of Lisieux in 1888 and survived only 9 more years. Still, her extraordinary holiness and prayer life prompted her superiors to have her write an autobiography, The Story of a Soul. It became a spiritual classic.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Open Forum, Jimmy Akin. Catholic Answers Live. Your call is welcome. One line open right now, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We're going to Cincinnati, Ohio now. Dave is listening on Sacred Heart Radio in Cincinnati. Dave, you there with us?
Peace be with you.
And with your spirit. How'd I do? Did I get that? Did I do it? What do you think, Dave?
It's a work in progress.
Oh, come on now, man. All right, go ahead with your question. Now you wished me peace, and then you disturbed my peace, Dave.
I answered your question, and now I'm getting reprimanded for answering your question.
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. Go ahead with your question.
Apology
for Jimmy.
Accepted. Jimmy,
howdy.
I know what you have to put up with.
You have no idea, Dave.
I don't, and I feel sorry for you, Jimmy.
Yeah, it's okay. Don't feel too sorry for me.
Okay, I will. The antediluvians, mm-hmm. the folks that lived before the flood.
Yep.
How come they lived so long, and why is Enoch missing? And that's my question.
Okay. So so for folks who may not be familiar, the flood occurs in Genesis 6-9, and the lifespans of the people who were mentioned before that, in particular in Genesis 5, are phenomenally long. They all live into hundreds of years. Some of them, like Methuselah, live almost 1,000 years. And then after the flood, even though Noah himself does live for hundreds of years, the lifespans start to drop off pretty quickly thereafter. But it takes a number of generations for that to happen. Now, there's a question about how do we interpret these ages. One option is to interpret them fully literally, according to the way that years are currently reckoned. So yeah. These are 365-day years. Another option that has been discussed is to say, well, they're literal, but they're not according to the modern reckoning. Instead, maybe one of these years represents something like a month or something like that. And then a third possibility is these years are not meant to be literal. Now, if you take the first approach, there would be a question of, well, so why would they live so much longer than we do? And the answer for that would have to be purely speculative. I've seen various speculations that have been offered. I'm not particularly impressed by any of them. It could either be something on a natural level, where they just had their really long telomeres or something mm-hmm. in their cells so they didn't age the way we do. And then over the course of time, there was genetic damage that then led to a shortening of the human lifespan. However, that we don't have any evidence for that. That is that we don't have any evidence of scientifically in the human genome of anything like that happening. So scientifically, that's not plausible. Hypothetically, they could be supported by God's grace in a way that overrode what their bodies would normally do in the aging process. And so they could have been supernaturally kept from aging and kept from dying. Then that might not leave traces in the biological record. What about the second theory, that these are literal but not according to modern reckoning? Maybe a year in this system is something like a month. Problem is, you do that, the math doesn't work. The lifespans still don't match up, and the age at which they become fathers still doesn't match up. So, like, if someone is said to become a father at age 130, well, 100, you know, some of
seems
these
seems awfully unlikely.
Yeah, some of these, not necessarily that one, but some of them would be very improbable. Also, the fact that the ages drop without changing anything about the language,
right,
means that at some point we are shifting over to modern reckoning. So that's a strike against this being some other form of reckoning, because you've got this relatively smooth drop in the ages. And so that brings us to the third possibility, which is maybe these ages are not literal at all. Maybe they're symbolic numbers that are meant to communicate something. And this is actually common in ancient literature. We find, in Babylonian literature and in Sumerian literature, we find similar ages being attributed to people who lived in the distant past. and who were regarded as great heroes and founders of society and things like that. And so in the scholarly community, a standard view is that these are symbolic ages that are meant to communicate the greatness of the ancients, but they're not meant to tell us literally how long they lived. And there may be additional meanings in them. For example, Enoch, you mentioned. Now, the reason Enoch does not have a fantastically long life, at least not as long as some of the other people like Methuselah, is because God takes him early. He is taken at age 365, and it says he walked with God and he was not, for God took him. And in the literature, from the first and second temple, this is especially from the second temple, this is understood to mean that God took him to heaven physically. So he ascended, or was assumed, I should say, like Mary was, and one of a few individuals, also Elijah. The same thing happened to him. So that's the reason he doesn't get a like 900-year lifespan. But you'll notice something about Enoch's lifespan. Sykelet, how long was Enoch's lifespan in years?
I don't remember.
365.
Oh, that sounds...
What else do you know about the number 365?
It's in the subtitle of one of your books. Also, it's it's the length of a year.
It's the length of a year.
Yeah. Right.
And so that has led to people saying, oh, guess what? Enoch's lifespan is, fantastically long, and it just happens to be the number of days in a year. Maybe that's a clue that this is a symbolic rather than a literal number. And there have even been suggestions that if you look at the ages of the other antediluvian patriarchs, that there are mathematical patterns in them, which may indicate that they're symbolic. And some of these, it's even been proposed that these are astronomical mathematical patterns, like is obviously the case with Enoch.
Thanks so much for that question. Just because Enoch got mentioned, I'm going to take this as an opportunity to mention something for you, David, that you might be interested in. We did a long conversation with Tim Staples about the person of Enoch and the mentions of Enoch in the Old Testament, New Testament, and even in the
Did you cover the Book of Enoch?
The Ancient Book of Enoch, yeah, which is not a book of the Bible, but
it is if you're an Ethiopian Orthodox.
Thank you. That's very true. Yes. So I think that'll probably dropped July 26th. But I can't be absolutely certain of the date. But check out Catholic Answers Focus on July 26th. Why isn't the Book of Enoch in the Bible? Where we talk all about Enoch with Tim Staples. Let's go now to Georgia. Logan in Georgia, you are up next. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Si and Jimmy. How are y'all?
Very well. Thank you, Logan. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm a new Catholic, and I spent a little over 2 years looking into Catholicism and becoming Catholic and, of course, watching Catholic Answers. And I still, I'm pretty good as far as my understanding, and I don't really have any hang-ups, but I do get asked some hard questions every now and then. And one that has been recent is the correlation or the what seems to be a connection between the Star of David and the Star of Remphan.
Okay.
That is mentioned in Acts 7:43.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, the Seal of Solomon. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could enlighten me to how I can answer questions about that and if they're the same and where the Star of Remphan came from and where the Star of David came from.
I got to say, Logan, Okay. Well, first of all, welcome to church. That's the first time I have heard that question, so I am anxious to hear the answer myself.
So I would have to – the first thing, if someone came to me and started making these claims, I'd say, well, show me your evidence. If you're claiming there's some kind of connection between these two things, how do you know that? And what's the quality of the sources that you're relying on for that? Because I know of no scholar who regards the Star of David – as having any connection with the Star of Remphan. The Star of David is a symbol that has been used. It was not originally, it's just a six-pointed star. It's two intersecting triangles. And it was not originally a uniquely Jewish symbol. It was used in the Middle Ages in some Jewish circles. It was known sometimes as the Seal of Solomon or the Shield of David, but this we're talking in the Middle Ages. This is, you know, 1,000 years after the Book of Acts was written. Also, it only really became broadly recognized as a symbol of Judaism in the last few centuries. This is actually a really recent development in Jewish iconography. So it's a recent symbol. Now, in terms of the star Remphan or Rephan, depending on which text you're looking at, it's actually referred to not just in Acts, it's also referred to elsewhere. That's entirely different. Now, obviously, you have knowledge of this star and its god that would go by the same name in the ancient world. It was known in the Old Testament period. It's known in the New Testament period. And what it is Saturn. It's just a name for the star or wandering star, Asteres Planetes, the wandering star or planet, Saturn. And like many peoples in the ancient world, some people who were pagan regarded the planets as being deities and or at least having deities. And Saturn was one of those. Because it was one of the wandering stars, it behaved differently than other stars. It attracted correspondingly more attention, and so it was considered in various religious and astrological systems.
Does that help you there, Logan?
That's some knowledge that I've researched myself, and really I have a hard time trying to convince somebody when you look them up and they look pretty similar. Then there's also the aspect that online some people will say that it represents the number, the mark of the beast, 666. And
is this just so I know, Logan, is this being used in a kind of anti-Catholic way to suggest that something against the Catholic Church?
So you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him think. There's only so much you can do with people. And if they're not willing to be sensible and look at evidence, then at some point you need to say, you know, I'm going to spend my time on something more constructive than trying to convince someone who's not open-minded enough to look at the evidence in a serious, fair-minded way. You can explain to them, look, just because there are parallels between two things does not mean there's a causal connection. There are stars and depictions of stars in every culture because the stars are up in the sky and seen by every culture. Sometimes you're going to see a star depicted with 6 points, sometimes with 4 points, sometimes with 5 points, sometimes with a dot or a circle. But there are only so many ways of accurately depicting what a star looks like. So of course there are going to be repetitions across different cultures. Even if there is a causal connection that maybe one culture's art decided to borrow an element from another culture's art in how we're going to depict something, that doesn't mean it's sinister. So you might talk to your friends about parallel evolution of ideas, like how stars get depicted in different cultures, and the genetic fallacy. The genetic fallacy is judging something based on where it came from rather than what its own merits are. So basically, correlation is not causation, and judge a thing on its own merits, not by its history.
Logan, as you kind of continue being formed in the faith and also trying to share it with others, I think you'll enjoy Jimmy's 20 Answers book, Anti-Catholic Myths. It does seem like you're working on confronting anti-Catholic myths. So if you want to hang on the line, Nathaniel will get your information and send you a copy of Anti-Catholic Myths. And again, welcome home to the Catholic Church. That's beautiful news. Jimmy Akin, you're going to... You'll be here another hour with us, yes?
Only if you want me to.
I want you to.
Okay.
All right. Do we need to take a vote, or you'll just go on my...
Well, I'll take your word.
Okay. All right. Jimmy Akin, another hour. Looks like every line is full. So if you are on the line, stay on the line. There will be one line open because Logan will give us his information. We'll send him the book, and then a line will be open. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. It's open forum. That means open to whatever question you have and open to everyone, whether you are a Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not. We'd be happy to take your call. 888-318-7884.